If your inbox looks anything like mine, it's basically a zoo. Newsletters you forgot you signed up for, ads pretending to be personal messages, LinkedIn telling you someone you barely know had a birthday, you know what I mean. But if you've been on the internet a while, you might have noticed that over the years, most emails have developed from boring gray walls of text to fancily designed tiny web pages. But what if the same styling technology that makes your emails look nice could also help attackers spy on you or even read your messages fully? My guest today, Leon Trampert, has figured out a way to coax the styling code behind these tiny web pages, CSS, into revealing a whole lot more about you than you would probably like. So, should we go back to the boring gray emails of days past, or even delete our email clients altogether? Let's find out. Hi, and welcome back to CISPA TLDR, the podcast from the CISPA Helmholtz Center for Information Security, where we talk about cybersecurity and AI in plain language. No buzzwords, no prerequisites, just real conversations with the researchers working on these challenges. I'm Tobias Ebelshäuser from the communications team, and don't worry, like many of you, I am not a computer scientist myself. Today, we're going to talk a lot about emails. Now, if you've been following us for a while, you may remember our episode on email security with Ben Stock, where we've talked about emails and their security in very broad terms. Check that episode out as well in case you haven't listened to it yet. Now to today's guest, Leon Trampert, PhD student at CISPA working in system security. Hi, Leon. Glad to have you on board.
I'm happy to be here.
So, Leon, when I open my email inbox these days, most emails look like mini websites. Gone are the days of gray, plain text mails. What is actually happening under the hood of these fancy emails?
So basically, you're right on. It's basically a mini website. So you have plain text emails where you just write some text and that text is then displayed and sent over the internet. But on the other side, you also can send HTML emails, which is basically just like a mini website. And here you also have a lot of the capabilities that you have for websites. So you can, for example, have text that is in a different font. You can color it, you can move it, you can have tables, you can have images, and so on.
So our email clients nowadays are basically web browsers.
Yes, basically. And in particular, if you have a webmail like Gmail or whatever, then you're already using your browser to view those emails. So it is basically exactly the same.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, but what exactly is responsible for making those newsletters look so shiny?
So we have HTML, which defines the structure. So if we, for example, have a table, then we have like the left side of a table is also visual, basically separated in the code there. And we also have the right side of the table and so on. And then we have CSS cascading style sheets, which define how it all looks. So you can, for example, change the font, you can change the color, you can set background images. You can do a lot of fancy things here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so as I've said, not a computer scientist, but I remember CSS from a very basic HTML class I took at university where we just built like a, for some extra credit, we built a very basic website. CSS didn't really seem particularly dangerous at that point. It just basically turned my fonts blue or something like that. But your research now shows that you can do attacks with the help of CSS, so it's not just decoration anymore. If it was originally designed for visuals, how did it end up becoming so powerful that it now there's research papers on its security issues?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Like the basic blocks of CSS have been the same for two decades or something, right? So you can have text, you can have color it, you can change the fonts and all of these typography things. And you also had background images and so on always inside of that. But then there has been the slow introduction of a bunch of conditions that you can put on that. The most prominent one is media queries, where you, for example, ask, what is the screen size? Mm-hmm. If the screen size is, for example, 1920 times 1080, then I set the font size to this. Otherwise, I set the font size to something smaller, for example. And
which was basically a requirement because now everyone is using their phones and their Exactly. Computers at the same time.
So we have these responsive websites where if you resize it and so on, it changes.
Yeah.
And all of that is basically made possible by these conditions. And these are also the conditions we then use to gather some information.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, we'll get to that in a second. So we can actually dive right in. So you've published two papers on CSS this year. So let's start with the first surprising result you got. That attackers can spy on the device you're using with the help of CSS, something you call fingerprinting. Now, as you write in your paper, normally attackers use JavaScript to spy on you or to fingerprint you, but you did this without any scripts at all. So why is turning off JavaScript usually seen as a protection, and why wasn't it enough in your case?
All right, so browser fingerprinting is basically just collecting as much information about a visitor as possible, without using any permanent state like cookies or something. So you, for example, what is prominently done is that you take a look at which fonts someone has installed, and this list of fonts actually changes with the applications that you have installed on your system. So if you, for example, install PowerPoint, you get some additional fonts, and then you can distinguish PowerPoint users and non-PowerPoint users. And if you do that for a lot of fonts, you get a quite good picture of how unique a user is. And this is something that is, for example, commonly done. And traditionally, this was done in the browser for if you, for example, have a captcha. This is one of the things that runs before you are served a captcha, because they look at how suspicious is your system.
Ah, okay.
Because if you have, for example, like a malicious attacker or something, they usually run inside of a virtual machine or something.
Yeah.
And you can then clearly differentiate, could this be a real user?
Okay.
Or is this just a default configuration with nothing added?
Okay.
And this is commonly done in JavaScript. And the only real tracking mechanism that has been available in email so far are called tracking pixels. It's basically images that are in the email. And once the image is loaded, the sender of the email can see that. And they basically know that you've received and opened the email.
Okay.
But what we have now done with the CSS and all of these conditions that we can do is we've basically made this that we don't only get, was it opened, yes or no? We also get the information, for example, was it opened and was it a Windows system? And we've basically built like a bunch of these conditions that we can also now apply in emails, which wasn't done before.
Okay, so you said the attacker could infer that I am using a Windows system or macOS, but so is that the only thing? What kind of things can CSS learn about me? Are we talking MacBook or are we talking, he has white socks?
Yeah, so it's all related to your system and mostly like to like the big stuff, like what operating system are you running on? What browser engine is it? So are you on Firefox? Are you on Chrome? You also can, for example, infer some of the default settings that someone has. So, for example, what is the language setting? We can take a look at which fonts are installed, which I've mentioned earlier, also correlates with the applications that are on your system. But you can't infer arbitrary stuff. So white socks and all of that is out of reach of CSS. It's mainly related to like what screen size, what fonts, what operating system.
Okay, but... So luckily, it's not yet possible to like pinpoint a specific device. You can only get broad combinations of...
Yeah, so basically when we're talking about we can identify someone, it's usually they are identifiable within like a specific group of people.
Okay.
So one common scenario would be that you have, for example, a corporate environment and everybody is using macOS and now someone opens the email on a Windows system and then you know, okay. This was suspicious.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Or this wasn't the fingerprint that we've seen before.
Okay. So then we always get to the point of the podcast where I ask, like, who should worry about this kind of fingerprinting? Is it dangerous for everyday users or is it more like something for a high risk group? Like, I don't know, as you said, in a corporate environment or journalists. So
that's a good point because fingerprinting is always been like a, let's say, dual use technology because you can build some nice defenses against things. So you can, for example, look at a system and say, is it suspicious? Yes or no. For example, has an email account been compromised? Yes or no. But on the other hand, you can also do some tracking, like that you, for example, you send a newsletter and then you specifically target Apple users or something. Yeah. That would be something that is possible, but only on a so high level that I think the privacy aspect is not yet fully there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as privacy invasive as, let's say, cookies, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But it is definitely a privacy concern. But what I think is quite interesting that you can do that is you can build emails that look different depending on what system they are now viewed on.
Okay.
So instead of sending the fingerprints back, we basically change the look of the email depending on the fingerprint. And then we can, for example, say we have a phishing email that only targets macOS users or only targets people who have PowerPoint installed.
Mm-hmm. So you could like build a profile or an avatar of like someone who is, I don't know, very gullible and said, okay, if they're using these apps, they're more likely to be fooled by...
Yeah, or you can just go for plausibility, right? Please update your PowerPoint.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Then you have a button, update your PowerPoint.
So you could basically tailor it to your specific victim, which then makes it sound a little more dangerous.
Yes. So like these targeted phishing emails could become a thing, I think.
Yeah.
And also, we're not sure how phishing detection works on like, let's say, Gmail or something. Mm-hmm. Because if they also look at the email... then you could, for example, target those people specifically and show them nothing. You show them a regular email if they want to see, is it a phishing email, yes or no? And to the actual phishing targets, you show the phishing email.
Ah. Okay, so you don't know yet how it works? Is it a, because it's basically their trade secret?
Yes, it's all basically a opaque box. We don't know what's happening.
Okay,
it apparently works quite well.
Yeah.
But we, for example, don't know how much of that is just users reporting phishing emails or reputation of the domain or like the email address and how much of that is, for example, actually people looking at emails. Yeah. But we will never know.
Okay. Yeah, that's an interesting take. So I should care if someone is able to tell what kind of device I'm using, even if it's just for... I don't know. I don't want advertised. I don't want like personalized advertisements, because when I think of fingerprinting, that's always the first kind of use case that I get. As you said, with cookies, someone wants to know what I am using so they can say, okay, he's using a MacBook, so he might have a little more money than someone who's using a very old Windows PC. So
yeah, I mean, in that sense, like this phishing problem, I think could become relevant in once the phishing parties identify that for themselves. But on the other hand, it may also be that using such special features already makes your email more suspicious. That you can basically look at what do regular emails look like, what do phishing emails look like, and then you can compare what features they use. So it will only become apparent in like a few years, I guess, if adoption has really taken off.
But I think that brings me kind of to the part like, okay, what's the next step? How do we defend against it? I mean, you published it in your paper. Has there been any feedback? Have you contacted, I don't know, email providers, Gmail, people of that sort? Or is it something that they just said, well, okay, we know.
Yeah, so the thing here is all of this is basically by design. So we have looked at what CSS email clients support, and it's basically different for every client.
Mm-hmm.
And we have lenient clients that basically allow all modern CSS. But we also, for example, if you consider Outlook, up until I think 1 year ago or something, that has used the word rendering engine, which is the same as I think Internet Explorer 8 or something. And that just doesn't have all of this interesting new stuff because it's just too old.
Security by being obsolete.
Exactly. So it was basically not affected by all of our stuff just because it's so old.
Okay.
And that would also be like the first thing you could do as like an email provider is just don't allow certain features.
Mm-hmm.
Make it more restrictive. For example, don't allow these what is the screen size queries, and only allow, okay, I changed the color to blue.
But at this point of your research, there is like no specific action being done by anyone to fix this. It's just in the let's say, early stages?
So what has always been done, for example, also against these tracking pixels, is that you, for example, require a button press or something for images to be loaded.
Mm-hmm.
And then you basically can't exfiltrate the fingerprints to the email server the attacker server. Then you can't learn any information.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem that you have emails that look different depending on the system, that still persists. But this, I would guess, is also sort of an orthogonal problem because it's directly phishing. And phishing in itself is also a problem.
Yes.
Doesn't matter what phishing looks like or what they can specifically technically do. It's a problem either way because, I mean, most of the phishing is not that sophisticated and it still works. It just works because it's at scale. Yeah. I was also recently asked because like all of this also works like in the browser. In the browser, you of course also have JavaScript, but you could do the same. And was asked, are these CSS things even necessary in the browser? And like from a technological point of view, they definitely make sense. So all of this is, for example, it drastically speeds up how fast a website can be rendered. And from that perspective, they definitely make sense. They also have these side effects, but that is then, I guess, something we have to live with as well.
Yeah, I think to that question, we'll get later to that question, because first I want to talk about more of the stuff that can be done with the help of CSS that is, let's say, not intended at least. We've heard about fingerprinting. That's already bad, but there's more. Because in your second paper, you showed that CSS can actually extract the content of an email and send it to an attacker, even if that email is encrypted. Again, question, how can something that controls styles like colors, fonts, read the text of an email? That sounds, I don't know, impossible.
That is actually quite interesting and also sort of complicated. So it's like a multi-stage process.
Otherwise, you wouldn't be here.
Yes, otherwise it wouldn't be that interesting. So we have basically like a multi-stage process. And the thing that is at the core of all of that is that we can measure the width of text.
Mm-hmm.
So we can, for example, we have the word hello and we can measure the width. And let's say the width is, for example, 48 pixels.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can differentiate that hello from, let's say, hell, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And that is basically at the core of our entire technique. And then it's just about how do we get those width measurements to a place where we can infer the entire text.
Okay, so you're basically taking a ruler to when you see those release documents that are being blacked out, so you're basically taking a ruler and then inferring on what the words are.
Basically, I mean, and then we do that for every character. So we start with the first character, we measure the width of the first character, then we know the first character, then we go to the second character and we measure the width of that, then we know the second character and so on. And we do that until we've basically reached the end.
Okay, but how does it work? Do you have to know what the font is or?
So that is also a nice feature of CSS. We supply our own font, which gives every character a unique width. So we can, for example, A has a width of 1, B has a width of 2 and so on. And then we can just look at what was the width measurement, what was the width, and that directly tells us what the character was. Okay. And then we just do that for every single character, and ultimately we can learn the entire text.
But how do you influence that when, I don't know, someone, person A is sending an email to person B, in that case you would be person C? How could you affect, so person C would be the attacker, how could they affect like what is happening in the email?
Yeah, so in the email scenario, this is quite a strong threat model because you have to have someone on the path between like the sender and the receiver that is malicious and can add styles to the email.
Okay.
And because you don't and cannot directly read the email, because if you, for example, are the email server, then the emails are encrypted from the sender to the sender's email server, the sender's email server can read the email, then that server sends the email encrypted again to another server, but that server can also read the email again, and then that is distributed to the receiver.
Okay.
So everybody on the path can already read the email.
Yeah.
And what is done if you don't want that is that you can encrypt your emails again, which is called end-to-end encryption.
Yeah.
And here you have two options. You can choose PGP, which is like what the enthusiasts use. And you also have S/MIME, which is used in enterprise context, because then you have certificates and you trust everyone by default that is in your company and so on.
Yeah.
But that's like beyond the scope of what we did. Yeah. And in that case, they cannot view the message content, but they can influence the email. Because if you, for example, reply to an encrypted email, the encrypted part is, again, a subpart of a regular email.
Yeah.
So emails are just weird, backwards compatible text messages where the encrypted stuff is then inside of regular stuff. And this outside is something you can influence. And there you could, for example, as a malicious email server, for example, add our malicious CSS. And then once the client receives the email and decrypts it, our CSS is also applied.
Oh, okay.
To and the then, decrypted plain text.
Okay, and then you can change the font, you can measure the font, and then you can report back what is the message of that font.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. And basically just opening the email on the client's, like on the receiver side is enough, or do they have to interact with it somehow?
So that also depends on the client.
Yeah.
So because we need the ability to load remote content, so load images basically, because we as the server, the attacker server, want to get the content. So we need basically the ability to send that to us.
Okay.
And like in a lot of email clients, you actually then have a button that is required for that. So you have, in a lot of email clients, you then have two button presses. The first button is, do you want to decrypt the email? And the second button is, do you want to allow images?
Load content. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
This is configurable. So a lot of people, for example, have set that to load images by default or something. But depending on the configuration of the client, there may be interaction involved.
Okay. But if you have configured it to just, I don't know, display emails by default as they are intended, then the only, let's say, interaction would be to allow the decryption, which you would do if you receive an email.
Yeah, because you want to see the email.
Right? Yeah. Okay. 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 So taking a step back at that point, encrypted emails. One of the takeaways of our first episode on email security with Ben Stock that I've also referenced before was almost nobody uses encrypted emails in their private life. As you said, enterprise content, that is something, but enthusiasts, okay, they do exist, of course, otherwise you wouldn't be here again. But would this attack, or is that attack vector of like someone reading your email with the help of CSS something that works also on like regular run-of-the-mill emails? Or is it like just scope very limited to encrypted emails?
Yeah, this is very limited in scope, basically due to the requirement that the attacker can modify your email, but cannot read it directly.
Okay.
And this is only basically possible in like these cases where you have email end-to-end encryption, because otherwise all people that have access to your email, it's just there. They can directly read it.
Okay, so basically, there just isn't the need to actually apply an attack.
Exactly.
Because you as an email server can just...
Yeah, so it's basically just for the cases where you distrust your email server.
Yeah.
Or, for example, if you want to protect yourself in case, let's say, your system gets compromised, or your emails get compromised, or your mail server gets compromised, or whatever, that people that get your emails cannot necessarily read the emails for whatever reason.
Okay.
But that is a rather niche use case, I guess.
Okay, so at this point, you would say normal users that don't use encrypted emails shouldn't trust their email server anyway with, I don't know, if they have something to hide or privacy-sensitive data.
Yeah, so the email server, if you don't trust your email server, then you have to use encrypted emails.
Yeah.
But like the default is they have so much data on you either way. If you consider, let's say, Gmail, for example, they already know everything about you either way. So being able to read the emails isn't,
isn't
of most concern to a lot of people.
Yeah. As you said, like in this case, something more niche, but something that should still be explored.
Yeah, so there are like these two standards where we only looked at the PGP one. Mm-hmm. And the big problem is always, how do you get the encryption keys and how do you ensure how you communicate with the other party? And for S/MIME, that is solved by certificates. So there is someone higher up that tells you, yes, this is the right person. And then you, for example, sign a document and then you only get the certificate or something, like in your company. But with PGP, everybody can create their own credentials and then you exchange it independently of the email. So you, for example, put your key on your website and say, this is me, or you send it to your friend via post or whatever, and say, only trust my emails with this key. And we only looked at the first part where you have this key exchange. And this is very relevant if you, for example, have whistleblowers or something that want to communicate privately with, let's say, a news newspaper agency or something. And they don't, for example, want the government, which then, of course, also has the help of the email providers to spy on them.
Yeah.
And in that sense...
In that case, you wouldn't trust the email provider because they can just subpoena and said, okay, we here's a court order, show us that email.
And if you apply end-to-end encryption on those whistleblower emails, right, you're secure from the email provider colluding with the government.
Yeah.
Unless they, for example, use our annoying CSS.
Yeah. Okay, so there is still an actual use case that someone could have their data stolen. It's just, at this point, not for the everyday user that they shouldn't like disable HTML or CSS as a whole in their email client.
I mean, for privacy, that is not the worst thing you can do, right? Because we also talked about the first part that you can learn a bunch of information. And most emails come with a text fallback option so that you have an HTML version and the text version. Yeah. So in most cases, that actually works. Then preventing the loading of remote content is on the one hand good for privacy and on the other hand also stops like our fancy CSS attack, for example. But in general, most people don't have to worry, at least about the security aspect, because the people that are affected will probably know. So
because they like they do have something
and they also have a reason to use end-to-end encryption.
But still, it's very interesting. And so again, question, anyone working on these issues, or is it something that is also, as you said, by design and hard to be prevented?
Yeah, so this is definitely not by design. there was also a similar attack quite a few years back. And basically this project evolved because we thought there were probably fixes, but the fixes were quick and adapted to what the actual attack was and didn't fix the root cause, which is that you have these two contexts and they can interact with each other. So we have reported this to all of the affected email clients and they are currently working on fixes towards that.
Okay.
But on the other hand, it of course also requires user interaction. So the barrier of entry is already sort of high. So
so even just like for the user to know that this could happen.
Yeah. So like on the one hand, public outreach already fixes the issue to like the most affected people on some level. And on the other hand, you also have this that the vendors are now fixing on it. It's apparently quite difficult to fix because it requires re-architecting quite a lot of the how emails are currently rendered. But they're definitely working on that.
Okay. So I should not be worried the next time I open my IKEA newsletter.
No, for IKEA newsletters. I mean, unless you worry about IKEA trying to learn what operating system you're on, then...
They probably know.
Then maybe.
Okay. No, very nice. Okay, so maybe let's just zoom out a little to see both of these papers or both of these research projects in context. So both of them basically say CSS has become very good at what it does, being responsive, helping... Just people have a nice user experience. Like it's, I can say, I mean, it's more fun to see a pretty fancily designed email than a like a gray wall of text. But the question is, did we accidentally create a monster by making CSS so powerful without thinking about like, okay, what are the side effects? What is the security aspect?
Yeah, so To some extent, definitely. So, but the most concern were like systems which only had CSS and no JavaScript before, which is sort of a limited set of context, because like in the web context, you always had like vulnerabilities, which, for example, cross-site scripting, where you inject your scripts into another site and you can extract the secrets from that. And what you can now do is you can basically do the same with CSS to some extent again. But this then is only relevant for sites that have fixed their cross-site scripting issue and have a CSS injection issue. So like it's a rather niche use case again. So I guess...
So you would argue there are like bigger fish to fry first?
Yeah, it's a systemic issue. Yeah. So like these injection vulnerabilities should be prevented in general. It's regardless of the technology that you can inject.
Yeah.
So what we have now seen is that the CSS has become so powerful that it's actually very usable for a lot of these attacks. But CSS injections have always been an issue. They haven't, they just haven't been as powerful.
Yeah.
Now they are more powerful than before. On the other hand, that has of course also given a lot of benefits to like website developers, the browsers, which can optimize a lot of stuff now. But in general, the issue is more fundamental and the injection shouldn't be there regardless of what you can inject.
Okay, so how do we fix it?
Yeah, that is a good question. So like for the regular vulnerability side, there are a lot of mitigations that developers can do, which already apply from the previous vulnerabilities, for example, related to JavaScript. So you have sanitization, that you actually check what is being injected, that you disallow and allow certain things. So injection would
basically just someone else running code on my site? Or
basically, yes. Yeah. So if you, for example, have like a comment field on a website and the user can write JavaScript inside of that comment field, and then another person will see the comment and it will be JavaScript, which is executed, would be bad and is something that has happened in the past. And you could do that with CSS as well, that you have, for example, you check there is no JavaScript in there, but you allow CSS. Not a good idea. You shouldn't allow anything that is executed inside of that comment.
Yeah.
And there are ways to check for that. And there are also ways, if you didn't properly check it, to still help that, for example, it's not executed, which is like a second line of defense, is also something you can apply. So there are definitely a vast array of mitigations that you can do, which is like for the general vulnerability scenario. And on the other hand, for emails in particular, you could, for example, just reduce what CSS someone can run. Like the necessity to, for example, infer the screen size, argue, is that important? You could, of course, for example, increase the font size on lower resolution screens or something. That's something you could do. But
again,
the user could also just zoom. It's,
It's a trade-off again between like convenience and security.
Exactly. And someone has to make that trade-off explicitly.
Yeah.
And for themselves know what are the benefits and disadvantages of doing that. And yeah, it's just about informing people and
But it's always hard to put these kind of decisions on the user, right? Because who thinks of that when I definitely don't. When I open the newsletter, and I have a lot of them, unfortunately, then I just I don't think about, oh, what could this email do to me, right? So maybe it's something that is on the side of the developers to solve.
Definitely. But then you, for example, should have the option between an email client that, for example, says, privacy first, and we lock it down and whatever. Or you could, for example, take the approach of browsers that are privacy preserving, where you can have different privacy levels. You can have the highest privacy level, but then there's notes, okay, this will maybe break some emails.
Yeah,
you have a medium privacy level and you have a no privacy level, which then doesn't break any emails.
Okay, so it would be, that would be like a usability question on, do you want to have the nice, fancy, shiny internet, or do you want the less polished internet that keeps all your data safe?
Yes, it's basically exactly the same as with browsers, just again in the context of emails.
Okay. So maybe getting back to like email as a standard, because something that kind of stuck in my mind from the last episode on emails that Ben Stock said, he argued that email is just an ancient standard, you know? And so I guess my question is, are we really just duct taping an old system at this point when we kind of try to fix things? Or should we just rethink that thing entirely and discard it and build it like better, new?
Ooh, that's a very broad question. So I'm only concerned with like what HTML emails look like and so on. So like about how all of the delivery works and so on. I mean, some idea, but not to the level
not
that
the scope of your research
that I have some expertise on that. But for HTML emails, there is, for example, no standard.
Okay, that's so even better.
Every client can just do whatever they want, which, I mean, is on that side also hard for people that write emails, right? You want to have an email that looks consistent regardless of where it's opened.
Yeah.
And then you have like these services that tell you which features are supported by which number of clients, but that number is never 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And that is quite annoying. So there would be, I guess, some advantage to standardizing that to some extent. But then the problem is also everybody would have to implement that, which is also something that not everybody wants.
Yeah.
Like in the webmail context, it's trivial, right? You just have all of the web capabilities, so you just have to implement some filtering. But if you now consider the Outlook example, for example, with the word rendering engine from 20 years ago, then they would have to change all of that, which is major effort.
Yeah.
So probably not interested in that.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah, but standardization hasn't reached HTML emails yet.
All right. So maybe if I can just nail you down, if listeners take away one thing about CSS and email security, what should it be? Preferably not something that makes them delete their inbox, but I think you've done that quite well on taking out like the fear aspect of that.
Yeah, so I guess for like in general, the developer population, that CSS is quite powerful and shouldn't be underestimated, that you should in particular also ensure that you treat CSS with the same respect as as other, let's say, injection languages, for example.
Yeah.
And for regular users, it's basically just a common advice. Remote content, if you load images or something that has privacy implications, it starts with was the email opened, yes or not? And it ends at what operating system do you have?
Yeah.
It's basically a spectrum now, and allowing remote content always has these security implications. And plain text is always an option, which has basically no side effects.
Yeah.
And you can configure your email clients to, for example, allow basically show you the text email by default. And only if you press something, then you, for example, see the HTML email.
Okay. So I guess my takeaway is that always, I mean, it kind of repeats because I'm always surprised, but no matter where you look, there's always a way where information can leak without it actually being intended. So I guess it's just very good that there are people like you checking all this stuff out when there's like new stuff happening that no one thinks about.
Yeah, it's always also just interesting because we were just the first to really look at that in depth because, I mean, it has been out since 2021 and I just stumbled upon it in 2023 or something, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
We were like, yeah, someone should take a look at it. And then it actually turned out to be interesting. So it's always fun to play around with new things.
I guess that is like the ultimate goal, you know, that you see something and think it's like, huh, that's interesting. That's neat. Let's figure it out. And I think that's why how we even like got here in the first place.
Yeah, it's always good for researchers. If you see something, thanks. Thanks, Google, for that.
Yeah. Okay, Leon, thank you very much. But I can't leave you just yet because it's tradition. All of our guests get 5 quick questions at the end. So first one is, Be honest, do you still open HTML newsletters without fear?
Yes. I mostly subscribe to things that have all of my other information either way.
Yeah.
I don't get newsletters from unexpected parties. Mm-hmm. And if I already have an account at, let's say, IKEA.
They know who you are.
They already have my address either way.
Yeah. So. And they know if you buy a Kutbula or
yeah,
a cinnamon buns at a restaurant. Okay. Is there something that really surprised you while doing this line of research?
Definitely the security aspect. I was quite surprised to see how powerful CSS is, mm-hmm. and also how powerful it is in this email threat model, mm-hmm. and that all of that worked was basically a miracle. Because like you have to have a client that didn't have the proper isolation and still supports the features.
Okay.
And for every client that we found that had this lack of isolation, they also had the features.
Okay.
And like only 50% of clients had this feature. Oh. So great coincidence that there was this big overlap.
I mean, it's a great coincidence for your research, but a bad coincidence for the people that would be affected by this attack.
Yes, but that all of this fell into place was...
Yeah. Okay. If you weren't working in security, what would you be doing instead?
Probably teaching. Mm-hmm. Maybe high school or something.
Okay.
Maybe also computer science. Otherwise, maybe foreign languages or something.
So screaming at children when they open the web pages that they're not supposed to do. Well.
Exactly.
I mean, you can still switch, you know. So
Jonas, I can see your screen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Is there a security myth that you wish everyone would stop believing?
So the first one is probably like what VPNs do and what they don't, mm-hmm. because like there's all of these advertisements for
NordVPN.
This VPN does preserves your passwords, privacy, and whatever.
Yeah.
Usually, no one can read your passwords if you have like because everything is encrypted nowadays on the web. These VPNs just offer service on top that, for example, if you don't trust your internet service provider, that they don't learn what you do.
Like what kind of sites you visit.
For example. Yeah. But then, of course, the VPN knows. But it's just a decision of who to trust.
Yeah.
And the advertisement, I guess, is sort of in the direction of now everybody knows. If you don't want anybody to know, come to us.
Yeah.
Which is like, it's just a trade-off. Do you want your ISP mm-hmm. to know? Do you want your
VPN provider
to know? And also on the other side, the fear of these USB attacks, mm-hmm. where you have like, don't plug your phone into the charger or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think there has ever been a recorded attack in that direction. I mean, theoretically, it's possible, but it's also just an insane amount of effort to set up, let's say, at the airport.
Yeah, without ever knowing who's going to come by.
To just harvest random phones or something. And also like you need specific attacks for like all different types of devices and operating systems. And all of that effort, I really doubt that someone would do that if they had other options.
It sounds not really feasible,
And then it's probably a targeted attack. So those are like the two things that I had in mind.
Interesting. Okay, last question already. One security tool or habit that you would recommend to every listener?
An ad blocker, probably. Mm-hmm. Because, there's a lot of disingenuous advertisements out there. And getting rid of advertisements, not the worst thing you can do from a privacy perspective and security perspective at the same time.
Win-win.
Win-win.
Awesome. All right. Thank you very much, Leon. Thank you for joining us. It has been very fun learning about emails again and your unique attacks.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the podcast.
Okay, that wraps up this episode of TISPA TLDR. A huge thank you again to Leon for joining us and telling us all about these security risks in places where you would not particularly expect them. If you'd like to explore more of Leon's work, check out the links in the show notes. And if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And maybe leave us a rating or review. It really helps others discover this show. I am Tobias Ebelsweiser. Thank you very much for listening. And we'll be back soon with more stories from the world of cybersecurity and AI made simple. Until then, take care.